Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, April 5th, 2005, and we're convening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Our first item of business is public hearing continuation on Senate Bill 5516, which relates to the Insurance Pool Governing Board. So we'd like to invite Rocky King, the administrator, back up, and Jan Dean, his able assistant, and if we could begin with whatever comments you want to give relating to yesterday's testimony, and then we'd like to get into phase two and the agency overview. So,
okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And I want to take just kind of a minute from yesterday and talk a little bit about the group coverage versus individual coverage. We've focused a lot on the group coverage yesterday. It's important to understand that when the legislature said they wanted to dedicate 50% of the resources to covering people in group coverage, that at that point we were unsure of the number of people that would actually be eligible for group coverage. We knew there were some challenges because of the economy. People were dropping group coverage for dependent coverage. We knew there were some challenges because of the relationship with the state and employers in terms of fulfilling their process promises. So it has continued to grow. It just is growing at a very smaller level and rate than what we had ever anticipated. And the key was that we didn't want to open up individual coverage because we knew that out of the 135,000, 140,000 Oregonians between 100 and 200% of poverty that were uninsured, we didn't want them to overwhelm the program and fill it up with those that only had individual coverage. So we always kept that group open and held individual market closed. And it wasn't until recently that we finally said the group market was not going to make it. Measure 30 passed. We had to get through what was going to happen with the Oregon Health Plan standard population, and we opened it up to individual coverage. I want to assure you that there are a lot of people out there who do not have group coverage available to them that are coming into the program. We are kind of at maximum where that we can do administratively right now, which is between 800 and 1,000 enrollments per month in terms of for our staffing. So our sense is that we're going to fill the program, get to the 21,000. Once we get to that level, hopefully we'll be able to close. We will be able to close the individual market, but group will never be closed. All group will be able to take those people that terminate from the individual market, and we'll be able to replace those folks with people that we find that have group coverage available to them. So as we go up to that 21,000, it will be through the individual market. Once we get there, you'll start to see a slow shift towards the group market as they continue to come in, but we hold tight on the individual market. And that was a policy decision that we made last session and always talked about making sure that FEOP was always open to someone who had group coverage available to them. And that was simply based on the fact that it is a better buy than the individual market in that we can serve more people in the group than the individual over the long term.
Certainly it is on paper. But the reality, as we see it, is that you've got $23 million of maintenance of effort money that will be for this biennium that is unlikely to be there in 2 years. It generates another $55 million of federal match, so we're looking at over $80 million in this biennium. But it doesn't look likely that we will have that kind of money in 2 years. And so you're going to be going out to group employers and saying, we've got this money, I'd like to get you enrolled, but you need to understand that you may not have this money in 2 years, and so you may end up going back to your employees and saying, looks like we're going to cancel our group plan, or I'm going to have to pick this up. I mean, that doesn't sound real attractive to an employer, I wouldn't think.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you're right, Representative Richardson. We have been doing that, though, since 1997. As you know, FEOP, every biennium has to go through the budgeting process, and we've never been able to commit ourselves farther than the biennium in which we currently operate. Starting in about 3 or 4 or 5 months, there will be a variety of committees, including members of the legislature, I'm sure, that will be looking at putting together what's called Oregon Health Plan 3. That demonstration, I believe, is 2000. 2008. I want to say it ends in October of 2008. Am I correct, Mr. Borden? 2007. And 18 months ahead of time, we have to notify the federal government that we intend to put in a waiver application to either continue or change or modify what the state is doing. And 12 months prior to that date, an actual proposal has to go to the federal government, at which point series of negotiations will occur. The future of FEOP will depend upon what that Oregon Health Plan 3 looks like.
Okay, now, is the reason for this that we just have a set period of time for the present Oregon Health Plan and then it sunsets? I mean, I'm not real sure.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. The demonstration project is a five-year agreement between the federal government and the state of Oregon. So at the end of that 5 year, we have to have a new waiver approved and a demonstration project in place. So those decisions about FEOP will be made at that point.
Okay, Mr. Britton.
Mr. Chair and members, one of the questions that I have posed to the Department of Human Services is what their current plans are for developing this waiver. As Mr. King correctly stated, we must give the federal government 18 months worth or 18 months advance notice, and that is about a year from now, prior to the end of the current waiver. So we have to provide notice in about a year. And my question to the department was, what expectations do you have for legislative involvement in the development of that waiver, assuming that they want to make changes? Another possibility is to extend the current waiver, assuming that CMS would go along with that. But at least from my opinion, I think that we probably want some legislative oversight of that process and involvement in that process.
Okay, well, today is the first that I've heard about the OHP3 work group. Would you go into a little more detail about who's heading that up, where the discussion is at, who's planning on being invited to attend?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that they've got to that point yet of saying
they
meaning Department of Human Services.
Okay.
That would be Gary Weeks, and he can talk about that. I believe he follows us at some point. But we've really just laid out, I think, the time frames at this point that we have to follow and what the key decision points are. And I believe that and the waiver committee that will be put together will come from Department of Human Services and the governor's office. So I don't have any information at this point on that.
Mr. Chair. Senator Bates.
I believe that what you're saying is correct to a degree, but what the process has been before, I would assume it will be again the same process, is that we'll have a waiver committee set up. And that committee will be probably chosen by the Speaker of the House for the House and by the President for the Senate. It'll be representative majorities on both sides. And that group, that committee, as an oversight, will work with the DHS and the Governor's Office to put together what we think that a waiver should look like again. And that's what the process was last time we had to do this. And I expect that'll be one of the major issues we'll be dealing with the interim. I've had no conversations about this yet, other than I had a conversation with Barney Spate about the timelines of when that needs to be done and how it needs to be set up from that point of view, but no discussion about what that waiver looks like, what it would entail, what we continue or discontinue. It's a wide-open topic and should be a wide-open topic at this point. My expectation is that the way I've just outlined it will probably be the way that it plays out. With legislative oversight, determined, I expect, by leadership on both sides, the governor's office and DHS. The DHS offers us to a great degree, and this is some expertise. These are tricky things to put together, both from a policy point of view and politically, and just the detail of it can be very tricky, and we need LFO's help on that, as well as DHS's. And the process before worked well for this. I think everybody came out feeling like they were heard, and the waiver we put together was reasonable. And we got it back in the times we expected. There were some expectations we'd get it back very quickly, but most of us said it's not going to happen that fast. And I think it came back about like we expected. So my expectation, that's the way it'll work out. But it's a discussion that has to be opened up in the next month or two to get things set up for the interim.
Between the Speaker and the President?
Yeah. I assume it's on the radar screen. If it isn't, it should be, and we can talk to
it. If it isn't, it will be.
Yeah.
You and I can help bring it up.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Chair, actually there were three reviews of the waiver. There was what was called the Waiver Application Steering Committee that was made up of stakeholders and legislators from both the House and the Senate. They, and I believe Senator Winters was on that committee, they then developed a series of recommendations for that waiver. It went to a leadership committee made up of representatives of the House and the Senate, who then approved that particular waiver and made a recommendation to the full emergency board that then approved or disapproved the funding for that. So there is and will be, I think, in the future, great legislative involvement in the development of that waiver and what priorities and programs they want to submit to the federal government.
Okay, and you said that it was kind of three-phase. I understood phases two and three. Tell me about the first one again. Who actually did the work in your recollection? Before it went to the leadership committee?
Before it went, it was the Waiver Application Steering Committee. There were representatives from both the House and the Senate. There were the doctors, hospital association, physicians from Oregon Medical Association. There were health insurance agents. There were consumers. There were insurers. And I will look to Senator Bates and Senator Winters. Is that kind of the... I think the group...
It was...
Senator Winters.
It was actually a broad based group who worked on the initial discussion and isolated the components as to what was believed should be in the waiver. And then from there we had the second group. It seemed like we met forever, but anyway, we did. There was... it was a lengthy process. And it was a very comprehensive process that was used.
And it was great involvement from the legislature from the get-go, right from the very beginning. And I think that's what helped make it work, because when they actually went out for the waiver, when you go back for that waiver, you got to have everybody on the same page. You don't want, because that's going to be taken up by your delegation back there and taken to CMS. And if you haven't got everyone on the same page, it doesn't happen.
The other linkage to that, and I might add, is that some of us were also, and I know I was, involved with our congressional delegation as well as CMS to assure them that what we were doing here in Oregon had the sanction and the commitment, because you cannot get your waivers through back there without making certain you've gone the full circle, and that does include our congressional delegation who helps a lot. There was conversation with CMS. There was some conversation also with the White House. So it had broad input and as well as broad discussion in this state. So.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying.
And Ms. Chair, and I would add that the process they went through was not a rubber stamp process. It was very interesting because the leadership committee, made up of just legislators from the House and the Senate, did make changes in priorities in the waiver to what the initial waiver application steering committee had recommended. So it truly was, I think, a good oversight and part of the legislature, both through the leadership committee as well as the emergency board, who then had to establish the positions and the funding for the implementation of the waiver once received.
Okay. Thank you.
Not sure where you would like me to go here, Mr. Chair. And
first, we'd like to hear from Representative Henson.
Well, just a couple questions. You've got approximately 50 employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Henson, 52 that are permanent employees.
Okay. How many of those are actually involved in the processing of applications?
Mr. Chair, Representative Henson, I need to look at my org chart, but I believe that we have, and I should add that we have, in order to get up in 6 months or 7 months, which should have been 2 years, we have an additional 17 staff that we brought on to assist in eligibility and the phones that are limited duration or temporary employees that will phase out at some point. But we have, out of the 52, I want to say there are 13 in the application review of application. I want to say that there are approximately 8 or 9 who do what was called enrollment and billing once somebody gets insured. We have 4 or 5 customer service staff that do nothing but answer the phones. As you, I think I've shared with you, we get approximately 2,500 to 3,000 phone calls a week. So we have 4 or 5 staff that do that. That's on page under agency organization. If you turn to, I think it's the second tab.
Well, I guess my point is with the a few minutes ago you mentioned that about 1,000 applications a month would be about the peak of what you could be processing.
That is correct, Mr. Hanson. Okay,
that would be what, about 50 a business day?
Representative Hanson, that is correct.
Okay. Well, I'm just the relationship between the number of employees that are involved in that and the number of applications that you feel that you can process. It seems to me that maybe you should be taking a look at either you had mentioned earlier that you had double audited or that you audited all of the applications. You had them checked twice to make sure there were no errors.
Yes.
I'm just thinking that the overhead percentage of this is pretty heavy, and whether there are some different processes that you could examine and put in, whether it's the monthly reimbursement, the verification on a monthly basis. There are some other programs which probably shouldn't be models of efficiency, but for example, food stamps. If we had to audit every food stamp application, that would take hundreds of additional employees. If there was some smoother, more efficient way to verify the income levels through possibly checking of employment records or something like that, I'm just thinking that there might be a less costly way to either wade through the paperwork or else get more applications done with fewer people.
But Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, first of all, that's approved. That doesn't mean we also have a large number of applications that aren't approved, that aren't in that figure. So if we're only approving 60%, for example, and I'm not sure what that approval rate is right now, that means you're actually doing 1,800 a day, those that you aren't approving. Secondly, as we do...
Have you compared your process for processing applications with those of commercial insurers?
Mr. Chair, very different. Commercial insurers don't care about where someone's employed, what their income is, whether they've been working, whether they've been uninsured for 6 months. That basically is a health questionnaire that someone fills out, and it is an entirely a different process. I also have the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is basically an insurance company. It is a separate, completely separate process, separate application, different information than from a regular insurance policy. We do, and get to Representative Hanson's question, we do check with Department of Employment to verify income. We do check through the screens, eligibility screens of Department of Human Resources to assure ourselves that they're, what other kinds of assistance they're getting, whether it be medical or food stamps or whatever it might be. So those things are done. That adds to the cost. As you know, the legislature at the last session and during the interim last year got very, very concerned with the eligibility processes and the audits that were done by the Secretary of State with Department of Human Services and the Medicaid program, and DHS took a lot of lumps for the number of people that were found not to be eligible that had been left in the program. And we made a decision very early on, because of our limited funding, that those folks that were going to get into the program because of the substantial subsidies and the length of time, 12 months of eligibility, that we were going to do the best job that we could. I should add, when I say every application is audited, that doesn't mean you spend an hour auditing an application. Basically, we have a checklist to go through, and we have two auditors. We've assigned four now because we're going so fast on our eligibility trying to get it up. But they basically look at some key things to make sure that the right subsidy level has been determined, that the right people within the family are being covered, So it's really not a redoing of the application. It's really a checklist of that. But we feel that the 10% level of administrative cost is a reasonable one, and we're going to be at that level.
Thank you. That's certainly certainly an explanation, but I don't still don't know if I'm totally satisfied in terms of the policy behind it. But that's not my job to question your policies. It's our job is to create your budget.
Okay, Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What percentage of your applications are rejected because they are either over the income limit or you find in your process of review that the information is not accurate or for whatever reason? What percentage are rejected?
Excuse me. Nicole is not here. Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we can get you that information. It's collected and reported on a weekly and monthly basis, so I can get that to you. I just don't have it over in my head. I will say that the majority rejected are because of income, over the income.
Over the income. And if you did a comparison with the majority that were rejected because of income, have you done an analysis to determine what it cost you had those continued on or had you not rejected them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, if they just got into the mm-hmm. program, Senator Winters, no, I don't believe that we have. And if I understand the correction or the question, if somebody was at 210% of poverty rather than rejecting them, if we let them in, somehow they got in. Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, no, we have not. I will add that when we first started this program, and I think I may have shared this with you, we wanted to be as streamlined as possible, and we assumed that we were going to have a 5% error rate, that is 5% of the individuals that came into the program would, if we dug deeper, would not be eligible, and we tried to make the application as easy and the whole process. The problem we ran into, very frankly, in our random audits was by digging deeper through the audit process, which we had the ability to do, we found that there were a number of folks that were getting into the program that had considerable assets that if we would have known about it, eligibility or asked for information relative to those, they would not have gotten in. Let me give you an example of that.
Can I stop you for just a moment? Once you find that they had more assets, are you able then to go back and recapture or go after those dollars because I'm assuming that they sign a certification that this is how much their income, yada yada. So were you able to go back and bill and collect those dollars because of
Ms. Chair, Senator Winters, yes. If there was fraudulent omission or misrepresentation on the application, we were able to go back and collect that information. Let me give you an example of that a change in policy that makes it a little bit more difficult. We, when we first started, did not collect tax return information. It was basically self-declaring and 3 months' worth of income through their payroll stubs that they provided to us. In early audits, we found that there were people who had substantial assets that would not be listed on their application, who would not show up in their wage stubs, or people who had two jobs, but they only provided you with the wage stubs of one job. So we started asking almost 3 or 4 years ago for just a copy of your recent application. Well, what that told us is if people had more than one job, it was obvious to us right away. Secondly, it told us if they had other assets, for example, rental income, that wouldn't show up during the normal application process.
Okay, I don't mean to interrupt, but that's a good answer, but I think it's enough of an answer, okay? Yeah. And because we want to move ahead. Representative Hansen. Okay.
Thank you. In that same vein, do you do audits or check quality control checks on the people that have been turned down?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I want to say it's one-third of the applications that are turned down are automatically reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a random basis, one-third. And right now we're doing every application that's been approved, we're reviewing, again, that mm-hmm. simple checklist.
What's the error rate on the ones that have been turned down that you review?
Representative Hansen, Mr. Chair, I can get you that. I don't know what it is, but it's very, very small. And the error rate on people that are approved getting in is very small. Usually the error relates to the level of subsidy, whether it should have been 95% or 90%, as opposed to whether they should have got in or not. And sometimes those are just calculation errors. But the error rate of people that are being turned down is inappropriately is very, very small.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rocky, the 6 months without insurance requirement, I have a question about that, whether that's the federal rule or your rule, because it seems like, as an employer, I've got an employee that's working along. Our company insurance rate goes way up. They can't afford it. If this program was available and they could get some assistance immediately, they'd stay on the plan. But if you put the six-month requirement in there, one is that family goes without insurance, and two is then you have to wait till the entry dates into a commercial plan to get there. So it kind of creates a problem. My second question is, are IRA, 401k investments, are those considered part of their asset pool for eligibility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, first of all, on the IRA, no. Retirement accounts are not considered a part of the asset test, the $10,000 asset test. Secondly, your question regarding period of uninsurance. The Title 21 federal statutes require a period of uninsurance. Now, that can be one day or whatever may be established. During the waiver development process, the legislature, the governor's office at that point, decided that 6 months was an appropriate period of time. Now, it's kind of complicated here. If you didn't have a period of uninsurance, you have 600,000-700,000 folks out there, some of which already are insured, that would overwhelm the program. And the purpose of the Medicaid CHIP program, which also has a period of uninsurance, as well as FEOP, was to try to get at those that were chronically uninsured for a period of time. That provides for or creates some inequities that we all know about and have been debated a number of times. That is, you've got somebody that's working at a company and they're flipping hamburgers and however they did it, they got insurance. Next to them, they didn't get insurance. The person who didn't get insurance is eligible. The person who somehow found the funds to get insurance isn't eligible. That creates some inequities. The best way to say that was the legislature said, let's get everybody under the tent, get as many people insured in the state as we can. Then we're going to have to sit back and look at some of the equity issues. In fact, there is a bill or some legislation that's been introduced by, I believe, Representative Greenlich that remove some of that period of uninsurance for some specific situations as well as for families that have children. Whether that goes or not, I don't know. But that is a real key issue that's been debated every legislative session.
Representative Hanna, that was one of the things that I really wanted to eliminate from the legislation when it went through. I wanted to get rid of that waiting period because I felt it was so unfair, but there were other members that felt strongly, so I lost.
Right. Maybe we could go into certified plans. Could you go into that area?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to at this point. Let me give you a little background on the Insurance Pool Governing Board certified plans. Started initially by the legislature in 1987 because our uninsurance rate was about 20%. A lot of companies were not providing health insurance to their employees or, more importantly, to their employees' dependents. And so we started certified plans going back almost 16 years ago. They were very inexpensive. It was $53.33 for a $500 deductible plan, and we were told to go out and utilize a tax credit to help hopefully encourage businesses to enroll in these plans. Over the next 7-8 years, we put at our height in 1996-97 about 33,000 employees and dependents in these plans, and primarily small businesses, three, four employees, very small, what we call the mom-and-pop businesses. During the 12 years that we were in business, about 60,000 employees and dependents enrolled in those plans at one point. But in 1996-97, inflation was zero. We had guaranteed issue in the insurance market, a lot of reforms that the legislature put in place in 95, 93, and then eventually in 97, made it really not necessary to have the certified plans. The economy was going. Employer-based coverage was getting very, very strong. So we decided to recommend to the legislature, and they agreed to phase out those plans in 1999, and we phased out the remaining folks by the year 2000. Basically went from 33,000 down to zero over this phase-out time. There was no employee or employer subsidy. This was strictly the board coming together, designing lower-cost plans and putting them out there and letting them purchase them through the regular market. So all of our costs were basically marketing, information and referral, and design costs. Well, in 2001, as all of us know, the economy at that point was upside down. People were dropping insurance. So in 2003, a number of legislators sponsored a bill to get us back into the business of certified plans. So we have, with no funding, no extra resources to do that, we've absorbed those costs the best we could. And primarily what that's meant is it's taken us longer to put it out there than what we had originally anticipated. So we designed those plans, two new plans that became effective March 1 of this year. During February and March, we went out and trained health insurance agents and insurance companies in 25 cities. And we basically designed two plans. One, it's called the Alternative Group Plan. Basically, it's targeted to be about 30% cheaper than what most group market plans sell for. And we did that by basically cutting benefits and increasing cost sharing. So we have a very high deductible plan, or we have internal limits on some services, skilled nursing care, some of those things. And we also excluded mental health and chemical dependency benefits, which saves you some money, but not a lot. At the same time we were doing that for employees and for their spouses, there was a real strong feeling on the part of the legislature, the advocates, that was not an appropriate plan for children. So we designed what's called the Children's Insurance Plan.
Would you interrupt just for a moment to go back to your comment that mental health and I think you said drug and alcohol are excluded, but they are not much of a cost. If there's not much of a cost, why were they excluded?
Mr. Chair, when we say not much of a cost, a lot of people think they're 20% or 15%. When you're trying to get a 30% decrease in cost, 2%, something that costs you 2% or 4% or 5% is considerable in comparison to that 30%. In terms of the overall health care cost, it's not a lot. But they were excluded simply because we wanted to try to get to that 30%. And everything that we limited or reduced or cost shifted was to try to get to that 30%. If we didn't exclude some benefits, then there was no reason for us to put a plan out there because the carriers can do it today. So we had to somehow make ourselves somewhat different than what was generally available out there in the market. Otherwise, there would be no reason for us to get into competition with the regular market. There is a period of uninsurance put on those businesses that purchased the plan. They had to be uninsured as of July 1, 2003, and the concern there was that you would get employers dropping their existing coverage and coming into a lower-cost plan. So many of the advocates were very concerned that businesses would do that, so a period of uninsurance was put in to that legislation. The children's plan, which can be purchased separately from the alternative plan for adults, is a $500 very good plan and includes all the mental health, chemical dependency mandates, well baby care. It's a good package, I think, and better than most kids that are enrolled in with their group plans today.
Okay, Mr. Britton.
Rocky, when you said it's a $500 plan, what do you mean?
$500 deductible plan, Mr. Chair, Mr. Britton. It means that just most of us, I think, are familiar with our health insurance plans. The first $500 of services, covered services, you have to pay yourself before the insurance plan actually kicks in. except for certain things like preventative care or well baby care, which are what we call first dollar coverage. If you take your child in for immunizations, we don't wait for a $500 deductible. We'll cover those immunizations day one. If you take the one-year-old in for well baby care, that's not subject to the deductible. So there are some things that aren't subject to the deductible. A little bit different than the regular market, though, is that an employer can actually buy the children's plan without buying a plan to cover their employees. We're trying to go to very marginal businesses to some degree, those that just don't have the revenue to afford health insurance, and we're saying we're giving you some choices that generally you don't have in the regular market. First of all, you can cover your employees, you can cover your employees and their spouses, or if you so choose, you can cover just the children and not the employees. And it's really an experiment. It has a phase out of 2008. We wanted to try this to see if it would work and see if that we could entice some of those uninsured businesses into the fold. The problem...
Senator Winters.
Go ahead with your problem statement, then I'll ask you a question.
Yeah. Ms. Chair, the problem, of course, is that you are fighting again an economy that where you have many businesses either on the verge of dropping coverage, certainly lowering benefits, a lot of businesses that are dropping dependent coverage, high turnover in small businesses. You know, every year, 10,000 to 15,000 businesses go in and out of Oregon every year, and those are generally businesses under 10 employees. So trying to get those folks into the fold is going to be very difficult. We know that the carriers have provided during the last 30 days 200 to 300 quotes to small businesses. We won't know for another 2 to 3 months probably how many of those are going to take effect and actually enroll into that.
You said the problem is the volatility in the and the turnover rates in employment. How much of the premium does the employer pay, and how much does the employee pay?
Yeah, Ms. Chair, Senator Winters, the minimum premium that an employer can pay is $50 per family per month. Now, that's the minimum. As you know, employers will contribute generally for an employee a lot more. And what we just didn't want to have happen is they pay 100% of the employee, and that's fine. And if it for spousal or children coverage, then the employee would have to pick that up unless they were eligible for a FEOP subsidy, which could come in and help subsidize the purchase of the children's plan. So $50 is the minimum, but they can pay up to 100%. And, Ms. Chair, one of the questions I'm often asked is, what's the average premium? We didn't set a premium. We actually set the benefit level at this point, and the premium will depend on the census of the group. So if you have a bunch of 60-year-olds that are working for you, very frankly, your premium's going to be a lot higher than if you have a bunch of 20-year-olds working for you. If you know the group market, is the only way that basically they can establish the premium is not on the health risk of the group, but on the age of the group. So there's generally 4, 5, or 6 age categories when an insurer sets a rate, and it's called a census rate. They'll take you basically your average rate for your employer's group, and that's how they'll set the rate. The children's coverage will be between $100 and $150 per month per child, and I would say that you're probably in the $150 to $200 range for a 35-year-old employee per month. But again, we don't have experience yet to find out which one of those are enrolled or not enrolled.
Senator Wynn.
Mr. Chair, how does that compare with the commercial market on the children now, not on the other, on the children?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, the commercial market is probably in the group side, it's probably a little bit more expensive because it's a little better benefit than what normally the $1,000 deductible is purchased out there. On the individual market side, it's about equal to what you would pay for a child in the individual market.
Wait. In the individual market, for a child under 18, the premium is like $40 to $60 a month. I mean, having certain experience with that personally. So
I'm not real clear how you're into $200.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, it's not $200 for a child. That's for the adult. I would say that, and I could be wrong here, but I'll bring you in some individual market rates, but you won't find very many $60 rates for children for a $500 plan that has mental health chemical dependencies. Remember, in the individual market, generally, you don't even have mental health chemical dependency benefits.
Of course, as you said, that's a very low cost factor in the overall premium, so I wouldn't...
But it's still 4-5%. But what I'm saying to you is that you don't have... A lot of the benefits in the individual market are not available... a lot of benefits in the group market are not a part of the individual market plan. But there aren't a lot of $500 deductible plans out there for $60 a month. I don't know of one off the top of my head.
Mr. Chair, Rocky, last session, and there was legislatively, there was the desire on the part of some of us to actually accelerate and to really push the coverage of children. And going up to where we were 200% of poverty level through CHIP. Several reasons for that was, one is because our match rate is 28.72, number one. The other piece of that, and there had been some studies, or whether anecdotal or scientific, that suggest that if you get the children covered, that you can then, parents begin to take more interest in their own health. And so I was really interested in seeing that you were pushing for children, and I wanted to know what really intensive effort are you making, and if there's obstacles, what obstacles are you going to remove? Because I, with the kind of match, 28.72, and if you can, and 100, when you tell me $100 per, if it's greater than the commercial market, we will get there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, first of all, we are the commercial market. Our plans are offered by Regents and HealthNet. They're priced just like the commercial market for the children's plans. Okay.
If we did a comparison, what goes through you through to the commercial market should be comparable to if it was Blue Cross or whomever.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, it'll be a little bit different in our group market, because if you can only enroll children, then because of adverse selection, our price is going to be a little bit higher than what a general group plan for children would cost. It will be more priced like an individual market. The difference is, in the individual market, if you're healthy, you can get in. If you are not healthy, you can't get in. If you are a six-month-old baby and you apply to the individual market, your parents apply to get you in, there's no coverage prior to that, you're not going to get in. They're going to reject you. Because the highest costs for children, for example, are 0 to 1. That's where they get the highest costs for care for children. So we're guaranteed issue, and you can, because you can only enroll your children, our prices are going to be a little bit higher because of the risk exposure to the carriers. This is not a rate that is set in the public sector. It's a rate set by the private sector, reflecting the risk that the carrier and the benefits the carrier is going to provide. Ms. Chair and Senator Winters, one other thing. I should point out that in the FEOP program in the group market, again, 50% of the enrollments are children. And one of the things about the group market for FEOP that's important is that it is not the employee that we generally enroll into FEOP. Most employers pay 75, 80, 90, up to 100% of the premium for their employees. And the dependent coverage is where the low contribution levels are. So when you look at why we have so many children enrolled in the group market, it's because generally there's no or very low employer contribution towards the dependent coverage. So it's not the employees that we're out there subsidizing, although there may be a few of those cases. It generally is the spouse and the children of that employee where the contribution level is less than that 100 or 75%. As you know by our statistics, I think the average contribution is about 40%, and that usually relates to the dependent coverage. And, Mr. Chair, getting back to certified plans, and in the testimony that I provided 2 years ago on that, I will tell you that the same thing I told the committees then, I don't know if this is going to work. We weren't given any additional resources or marketing money to really work with this program. We're doing that by trying to save some money out of our different pockets to apply to some of the training and the publications we're putting out. You will start seeing in April some ads that we've put together with the Oregon Broadcasters Association, the Association of Oregon Broadcasters, that will start talking about the certified plans. We will start doing mail-outs to small businesses to try to get them involved, and these things will take place over the next 6 months, and hopefully by the next legislative session we're going to be able to say to you this worked or it didn't work.
Mr. Chair, just a question. How much did we pay Bill Shonley?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, $250.
$250?
$250, Senator Winters, which he donated to a charity rather than accepting it. But because he is a part of Actors Guild or whatever it is, he cannot waive his fee, but he can set his fee at the lowest level, and then he then gives that to charity.
A question about the way that the certified plans are functioning. Is Oregon an insurer, or is Oregon a coordinator, for an association that then has it underwritten through a private insurer? Would you mind explaining?
Mr. Chair, Oregon does not insure. All we do is we met with businesses, agents, stakeholders, and said, what should the plans look like? And that included legislators. I think we had three or four meetings with different legislative groups going through what our ideas are and what our plans were. We put those plans together, and then we went out to the insurance community and said, okay, you guys bid on them if you want to offer these. And it wasn't so much bid on price. It was just give us your best shot of coming out with these plans. Two of the major eight carriers decided to do that, and that was Regents and Health Net. The others did not because of the risk associated generally with the children's plan, giving the employer an ability to only insure the children of their employees created a lot of risk exposure to many from the viewpoint of many of the carriers, so only two really stepped up to the plate, and that was, again, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, which is statewide, and Health Net of Oregon, which is in 19 counties. So we do not insure. The only thing we do is really design the plans, and then to help keep some of the retention costs down, the state has always assumed since 1989 some responsibility for working with agents and employers and business associations to get the information out about the plans.
Okay. Questions up to now? All right. Forward.
I get lost, Mr. Chair, as to where you would like me to move forward to, because we've kind of skipped around quite a bit. I think I want to reiterate about the certified plans. It is an experiment. We wanted to come out and see that in today's environment whether it would work or not. That was a legislative decision. No one knew that there, or no one knows if this is a magic bullet, and I will tell you it's not a magic bullet. It may be just something that's a good alternative for a few businesses, but when you see the trend of uninsured going up, when you see the trend of small businesses dropping coverage or never purchasing coverage, this, I think, was an attempt by the legislature to put something out there to see if there were some takers, to see if we could get more people insured that normally would stay out of the market. And I think time will tell over the next year and a half as to whether this has been worth our effort.
Okay. Representative Henson.
I guess my concern would be if you don't have the dollars to promote the certified plans, and we're doing it as kind of a test market, that it would seem that it wouldn't be a real good test, just from the standpoint that you don't have the promotion dollars. I can't imagine a private business starting an endeavor without having some level of promotion or advertising. The other thing is how to keep the Health Net and Regency involved. How do they have goals in terms of how many policies that are going to have to be written, or how many children are going to have to be enrolled in order to keep them providing that product?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, a couple things. First of all, we are going to promote this. It's just going to take time to we just try to save money. We've got working with Oregon broadcasters, some ads coming out through their what they call non-sustaining commercial ad. That is, when they have unused inventory, they can plug us in better than public service announcements, which are usually at 2 in the morning. This is just unused inventory. We have saved money in terms of publications. We've tried to piggyback with the FEOP. Whenever we do training or outreach on FEOP, we bring in the certified plans. We're able to do some things. So we're trying to do that. But you're right. You know, if there were resources available, I am sure that the governor, I am sure that the legislature, I am sure that we as an agency would have proposed some additional funds to go out and do some outreach on this. But the reality is, when the bill passed, the legislature made it very plain there were no additional resources for you, Insurance Bull Governing Board. You just need to go out and do this. So, I mean, that we got the hand, and we're trying to deal with that.
Mr. King, in terms of the insurance information, education, and outreach portion of what you're doing, is that part of the marketing?
Ms. Chair, that is correct. That, for example, the agent referral, that serves both the certified plans, FEOP, and the general questions that we get from small businesses, because we're always out there doing something with the small businesses. And so we piggyback on all of those. But in terms of the blocks of money to do the big outreach, we've kind of had to cut back on some things and spread it out over 2 years rather than doing it within 6 months. But you raised a good question about the carriers and how many plans do they need. I don't think these carriers made this commitment on the basis of economics. Both Regents and Health Net stood up because the legislature said, let's go out and try to cover folks. They stood up because the governor said he's interested in figuring out ways to cover kids. If they probably had some sanity to them, and I think the others did, they probably would have said, let somebody else go test this market out, and we'll step back and see. They're not in it to make money. They're not in it to lose money, but they're certainly not in it to make money. Both carriers have committed to a year to see what we can get enrolled, and I think they will make a decision as to whether administratively, not on a risk basis, but in terms of their administrative cost, whether they've written enough plans to stay in for the remainder of the period that we're hoping to offer these. But I give a lot of credit to the private sector and those two carriers who stood up to try this, because there isn't a lot of dollars in it.
Hey, would you mind reviewing with us the provisions and the relationship with Senate Bill 303 and the change of the Insurance Pool Governing Board?
Mr. Chair, we have a variety of pieces of legislation that relate to the Insurance Pool Governing Board, one of which really looks at it from an organizational standpoint. And I smile because I was in a committee with Senator Mona Sanderson, who informed me she was just getting used to IPGB, and here we were going to come in and change it. The board, when it was first established in 1987 and 89, had two employees and a budget of about $250,000. And that was me, basically, back in 1990 as the first and longest employee with them. And it was operated by a board, and a board making decisions relative to $250,000 budget was pretty simple and continued that way until FEOP was established in 1997. And the governor and the legislature were concerned that a policy board was going to, have control over a multi-million dollar budget. So there was some legislation when FEOP was first established that gave more oversight and policy making to other parts of state government, including the Office of Health Plan Policy and Research, Dr. Bruce Goldberg. In 2002, when the program was really expanded, program meaning FEOP, to cover 25,000 people and bring in about $20 million of general funds.
Could we, like, cut to the chase?
Cut to the chase? The program is so big that having a policy board who has pretty much freedom to make policy decisions outside of the waiver and some of those constraints of the fiat program. The governor, I think, felt that it was important to have basically an agency director that reported through the regular chain of commands and making the policy board advisory so that we could ensure that there was better accountability between the administrator and the governor as to the policies of the legislature and the executive branch.
Okay, so the private health partnerships, is that
Office of Private Health Partnerships, you can't keep the same name, so they had to come up with a new name. I will tell you that we had 100 different names, and not that this received a majority of votes. This probably didn't receive any at all, but it was the name settled upon, because we are in every one of our programs really is a partnership with the private sector, whether it's the certified plans, private sector with business, whether it's FEOP, with the employers, the private carriers, the health insurance agents. So the name kind of was the Office of Private Health Partnerships.
It and basically will that be transfers a separate over. Agency, or will you be a subordinate agency?
It'll be an agency, Mr. Chair, in by itself. It'll have an administrator that then reports to the governor's office directly, as opposed to a board. Pardon?
You'll be that administrator?
Mr. Chair, the governor has indicated and that I would continue in that role. Even though I'm an OMIP employee, he would maintain the interagency agreement between the Department of Consumer Business Services and the new Office of Private Health Partnerships, and I would continue in that role.
Okay. Any questions on this transition?
Senator Lawrence Anderson. So, basically, IPGB is going away.
Senator Mona Sanderson, the name.
The name, yes.
And the board from a policy-making board to an advisory board.
Policy to advisory.
Okay. All right. Are there any other questions for Mr. King? Now, we may have some public testimony on this, so I think that you've given us all that
you
can handle
today.
Thank you very much. Are there... anyone in the audience, is there anyone who would like to testify? Do we have a sign-up sheet?
Hi, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Ellen Pinney, and I work with the Oregon Health Action Campaign. We have a long history with the Oregon Health Plan. I was on the Waiver Application Steering Committee. I was around when it was developed in 1989. I served on the Insurance Pool Governing Board when we hired Rocky and was part of that that original process of trying to find employers who had not insured their employees in it and try to get them to offer coverage. And I'm also an employer. Our coalition has always supported programs that expand access to health coverage for more Oregonians, including the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program and the Oregon Health Plan. I think it's an Oregon Health Plan Medicaid. We call the Family Health Insurance Program part of the Oregon Health Plan because, in fact, it draws down the same public resources and the same federal resources for the same target population, population with incomes at 185% of the federal poverty level. And we view both of those programs as an attempt to resolve the access crisis for the uninsured in this state. I want to speak to you first as an employer. I was interested in the questions that were asked yesterday. We believe as an employer that health access should be, or health coverage should be offered to our employees. We think it helps keep good employees. We pay 92% of employee coverage and 65% of dependent coverage. We recently had an employee about a year and a half ago who I recognized because of her she is a single parent, two kids, immediately found out that she had been uninsured for 6 months and realized that she could qualify for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. Had I enrolled her in our coverage as an employer without having connected her with the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program first, she would not have qualified because she needs to be uninsured for 6 months. And I am going to make some recommendations that might be helpful in terms of trying to get to employers like myself in advance so that we can take advantage of employer contributions to the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program pool. So as a half-time employee, she's an office manager, paid $13 an hour. She was a half-time employee. We pay 50% of her benefits. For her, that $300 out of her paycheck would have been too much, but she really wanted coverage for her children, so she would have paid it. Her income allowed for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program to pay 95% of her $300 contribution, which is a great bang for the public dollars. We're getting three lives covered for basically, you know, $280. And we called FEA up right away, and I have to say that of all the public agencies we work with, I find the Insurance Pool Governing Board to be one of the most responsive. They take their mission true to heart. They always provide data. They immediately provide an application for her. And for me as an employer, I got an application, too, because I had to provide information about our benefits product, our health insurance plan. I'm very closely involved with health care, and I have to say that as an employer, and somebody who's involved with healthcare, I found that application very difficult to fill out. I had to actually call our plan to get help figuring out how to answer some of the questions it asked me as an employer. And I think there are ways to improve that system. I think it's important to know that our office manager has left us. She's starting an independent business, and she continues to stay enrolled with FEAP. She gets COBRA. Her benefits continue through COBRA. She is now paying $511 a month for her health coverage, and the state continues to pay 95% of the cost of that program. At the point that you start looking at that cost to the state, comparing it, for example, to the cost of Medicaid OHP for her children, you have to wonder if it's the same bang for the buck that you're getting for the same dollar contribution. We are also the lead agency for covering kids and families in Oregon. We spend a lot of time, and our mission in that process is to maximize the enrollment of eligible uninsured children and families in publicly supported health programs, including the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program and Oregon Health Plan Medicaid. I think it was a very interesting conversation I had with a large employer who I was trying to get to advertise these programs, including FEAP. Again, employers have to be directly involved for their employees to take advantage of FEAP. And his comment was, we think these are great programs, Ellen, but I don't necessarily think it's a good idea for our employees to recognize that they might qualify for public assistance programs. I think that's an enormous cultural barrier to overcome. I kind of argued with him a little because, you know, we're an employer that offers FEAP. So I think that there's got to be a way to try to get employers actively engaged in advertising the availability of these programs, including FEAP, to their employees, and to try to get FEAP information in, you know, hiring packets. Because, again, had our employee taken advantage of our offer of health insurance, well, she had to take it because we don't have the ability as an employer to say so-and-so is not going to get coverage. She would have basically been faced paying costs that she could not afford. So I think it's important to get to employees at the point of hire.
I think that you did mention, though, that she would have paid it anyway, and so to say that she could not afford that may or may be a subjective determination that you're making for her, since there's a lot of families that struggle but would rather struggle before going on a state welfare program.
I think that's a very good observation, Mr. Chair. I think having worked with our staff person over the years and becoming a little more familiar with her personal affairs, I recognized that her life was a struggle ongoing, and that had she had to pay that $300 without getting support, it would have made her struggle that much harder. And I want to also share that at the point of her hire, I recognized that not only did she qualify for a FEAP subsidy, but again, her children qualified for CHIP OHP. And like we do as part of covering kids and families, I counseled her about the availability of both programs and the strengths and weaknesses as I see them. And I think it's important to put those on the table here, and in that for somebody who's enrolled in private insurance, they don't have as many problems finding doctors to see them, and they, you know, have an insurance card like everyone else. And for folks in Medicaid OHP, of course, as you know, all costs are covered for children, so she had to pay copays in our plan, but of course it's a lot more challenging to find a provider to see you. We are strongly supportive of both these programs, and as part of Covering Kids and Families, recognize that kids don't get enrolled in public programs unless their parents can also enroll. So we believe it's important to advertise both these programs. It's clear in our state of the 109,000 uninsured kids, 66,000 are eligible for programs. If Oregon Health Plan Medicaid did the kind of outreach and aggressive kind of community engagement that the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program did, if those two agencies coordinated their outreach efforts, if applications for both programs could apply for both programs, so when a parent fills out one, it could automatically be used to for eligibility or for an application for the other program, I think we could come closer to closing that gap on uninsurance rates among children. So I just want to share that I believe it's a great option for some people, but not for all people. And here's the problem we are facing now. As standard enrollment is closed, 100,000 folks have lost coverage off of OHP Medicaid standard. All of them, almost by definition, eligible for OHP Medicaid. We are being encouraged to enroll that population in FEOP, and we are taking advantage of that opportunity to every extent we can. Here's what that population faces.
If almost all of them would qualify for OHP Medicaid, then why were they part of the standard?
I'm sorry. I merged the two words together, Mr. Chair. So in my opinion, OHP includes Medicaid and standards. So the folks on standards, as you know, are not categorically eligible for Medicaid. They are part of the expansion population. And at this point, FEOP covers all expansion populations, and within OHP, the expansion populations are the standard, as you pointed out, in SHIP kids. So as we're losing folks to standard, clearly one of our efforts is to try to find out if they qualify for PLUS or if they're categorically eligible. But for the most part, the numbers show that they are not. They are falling into uninsurance. Assuming that they immediately apply to FEOP at the point they lose standard coverage, FEOP does an amazing job, turns around their application in 2 weeks and says, yes, you qualify. You're at 20% of the federal poverty level. You know, you're homeless, whatever. Many of these folks are in that boat. You qualify for our program. Now it's your job to go out and find private insurance. Here's a number of a few agents. You apply for private insurance. This is best case scenario. 2 to 3 weeks before you hear from an insurance carrier whether or not you get covered by that private carrier. For many of these folks, they have pre-existing conditions that date way back. So the carrier, at the point you apply to the carrier with your FEOP subsidy for an individual product, the carrier maybe takes, again, 2 to 3 weeks, maybe 3 to 4, to decide whether or not they will accept you. Chances are this population, they're rejected. That means they automatically are eligible for the high-risk pool. This is yet a third application process they have to go through. They have 63 days to be without health insurance before their pre-existing conditions count against them. For many folks, by the time they hit the high-risk pool, or OMIP as Rocky calls it, they have a 6-month pre-existing condition delay. We're talking about folks who may be taking 15 medications to keep themselves afloat and functional. They have no coverage for their health care needs for 6 months then. And that, I'm giving you the best case scenario, and in the best case scenario, it's unlikely that at the immediate point someone loses coverage off of OHP, they will be able to get into the high-risk pool within that 63 days that would allow some kind of continuity of coverage for the health services they need most. I also think it's important to look at the cost. Clearly, our coalition supported that part of the waiver which balanced employer and individual coverage costs for the state. We believe that having employers contribute something is an amazing resource for our state. But at the point that you start enrolling Medicaid eligibles or 100 expansion populations in the high-risk pool, and you look at the cost to the state for that program as compared to the cost of state for Oregon Health Plan Medicaid, I think you have to make some decisions about whether or not that is the best and most effective use of public resources. And I would just point out our employee as an example. Again, the state picking up 95% of a $511 COBRA payment covers two kids and the mom. And I would suggest for a lot more than what they would pay through Oregon Health Plan Medicaid. So here are my recommendations, and I maybe they're helpful. In my opinion, that the market, the target market for employers should be those who already offer, and because many of us hire part-time employees or employees who don't otherwise qualify and could get assistance paying their premiums. Somehow to get information into the hiring packet. And I actually heard this from Ellen Lowe, which I think was a brilliant idea, that the plan should be filling out these forms that we have to fill out as employers, suggesting so that we as employers don't have to struggle with, well, how do I fill out this form? It's just another hurdle to getting your...
Recommending that there be people on site at every employer who's hiring an employee to help fill out a plan?
No, I'm talking about the employer responsibility is to fill out a plan that shows what my health benefits are. And even I, as an employer who works in healthcare, could not understand some of the questions that form was asking me. I'm talking about the carriers, the insurance carriers, somehow being directly involved in filling out those forms on behalf of FIAP. So that I, as an employer, don't have to be taking my time to kind of negotiate that, Mr. Chair. I hope I made myself clear.
Okay, that. What you're saying is that the group insurers that currently provide the coverage for an employer ought to help with the FIAP application.
Right, that's right. Because the criteria, as Rocky pointed out, is whether your plan meets federal specs or not. And I would submit that probably most of them do. So I would be surprised, frankly. If many employer plans are rejected, that would be an interesting question, but I would be surprised if they were. If it concerns me that the way the waiver has been represented to you, we either have to use it or lose it, and we're going to lose a lot more than the waiver. And it seems to create an incentive to enroll everybody in FIAP, whether they're eligible for OHP Medicaid CHIP. Any life that FIAP loses now is potentially a life that is not contributing to the reaching that federal maintenance of effort level. And that is an amazingly perverse incentive to me. I mean, it seems to be, because, in fact, we know that the highest cost product that folks can get through the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program is through the high-risk pool, almost by definition. And I think that it is incumbent upon us as a state and you as policymakers to be aggressive about exploring ways of amending that waiver with the federal government so that maintenance of effort doesn't exclusively focus on what FIAP did before and after, but on what our expenditures have been across all expansion populations, including CHIP and Standard. And as you all know now, Standard is not in any way funded now by state public resources. If we're going to continue to use individual market products as kind of one of the biggest enrollment pieces for FIAP, then it seems there should be one application for all carriers. So if I as an individual am applying to, with the help of my agent, I'm applying to Kaiser and Blue Cross, Blue Shield, whoever it is, one application should qualify for all those programs, and that application should be used by OMEP if I am rejected. Somehow, the benefits people need, especially if we want to use FIAP as an option for Standard, need to be able to be addressed in the high-risk pool in OMIP. And perhaps it could be something around drug coverage so that people don't have to go without the benefits they need most. And if they don't receive them, I would submit those folks are a lot bigger cost to the state than is the cost of making sure that they have access to basic services, whether they're diabetic, whether they have mental health conditions that require prescriptions. The other problem we've noted is that for many of these clients, they get in the private insurance market and they do no longer have access to the providers that they have become familiar with. They lose access to the safety net clinics. Safety net clinics don't no longer get reimbursed. So is there a way of exploring for an enrollee in private insurance? Is there a way of exploring getting a private carrier or two to be contracting with safety net clinics or other kind of providers of the medically and economically vulnerable so that folks can continue to have access to the providers with whom they have developed relationships. I don't know. Somebody said, can Care Oregon be one of the high-risk pool carriers? I don't believe Care Oregon accepts private patients, but if, in fact, we want to ensure access for this population.
They did that.
That's got them in trouble.
Thank you very much. All right. Well, if there's some way of getting other carriers to be creative about creating relationships with school-based health centers, with safety net clinics, so that traditionally Medicaid OHP-eligible folks can continue to get services, I think we can be better sure that those products are delivering access for this very vulnerable population, who at this point has no choice, because unless they're categorically eligible and in standard now, they're not getting coverage unless they can get into the high-risk pool.
See, I didn't understand that. La Clinica, I met with them, and they're about a safety net clinic. They're and they take insurance, uninsured. They take it all. In fact, they welcome insurance and paying customers because it helps offset their overhead. So when you say they're excluded, I'm a little confused by that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know that there are some safety net clinics that have relationships with private insurers, but not all of them do. And I think it's worth an exploration of. For example, Central City Concern is where many folks on standard, and that's in Portland, and that provides services for folks who are homeless and chronically mentally ill.
Let me interrupt just a moment, Senator Bates.
Well, I want to ask two questions, but I want to go back to what you're talking about here. Are they, Mr. Chair, are they prescribed by their charter or by law that they can't take commercial insurance? I mean, having a relationship with a commercial insurance company isn't that hard. You sign up to get a provider number and for those patients coming through there, you bill them and get paid. It can be done electronically. It's a little more complicated then, but are they prevented from doing that? Because, I mean, the ones in my area do. They take commercial insurance. That's not their main book of business, so to speak, but they might take people who are uninsured and OHP, but they do take commercial carriers too.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, I think it depends on the insurance product that you end up getting, and I think you need to look at the high-risk pool and whether the carriers in that pool are contracting with the clinics in your area and other clinics. And I think it does. It is my understanding that it varies based on the plan and the community. Just like, for example, some plans who contract to provide Medicaid managed care services do not enter into contracts with the safety net clinics in their area. It's been an enormous issue for some of those safety net clinics.
Bogged down in that. We can get clarification on that. Did you have other recommendations?
No, Mr. Chair, except that I guess my parting hope would be that we do not accept the maintenance of effort requirement for FEAP as kind of our marching orders to ignore the fact that we have two separate programs and to figure out maybe creative ways to make sure that the public resources we spend on healthcare, whether they are in FEAP or in OHP Medicaid, are getting the biggest bang for our buck. And when I say that, I mean ensuring access and providing coverage to the greatest number of people possible. And I'm not sure in all cases the Family Health Insurance Assistance programs provide that big bang for the buck, as I hope that some of my examples allow you to see.
Okay, I think that's a good point. I mean, the goal is not necessarily just to spend $81 million because it's there. I mean, it is tax money, and so getting the best bang for a buck is certainly important. Can you tell us what kind of a waiting period you have in your company when you hire a new employee before they have health benefit coverage?
We have no waiting period.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that struck me through the conversation on this program, which I strongly support, and I like public-private cooperation. I think it's a good way to go. In the long run, like, overall, it's a better way of going than just a straight state program. But having said that, I've been concerned about this program's high overhead costs, primarily, I believe, as a result of they have to do means testing and get through that means testing. And I think that's some of the testimony we just heard about is there. What I would like to explore at a later time is whether or not DHS, which does means testing for OHP, whether they can do the means testing for this program for OMEP. And so when an individual comes in, they make one phone call, a means test is done, or said, this is the program for you, here's the single piece of paper you have to fill out for it, and it's over with. That's the kind of program I'd like to see happen. We've seen that happen in our county with the way we've done things by localizing things where you come in and all your services are right there in one place. I wonder if we couldn't do the same thing in healthcare, and the potential, I would hope, for lowering those costs would be significant because you're not duplicating efforts anymore. You're not running the patient over here to say, try OHP first. Oh, you didn't qualify. Try, you didn't qualify. Now you can try OMIP. Why don't we have one place to go to make it clean and simple, if we can, and run it all through that one organization? Because when you add up the cost of what they have to do in order to meet federal requirements as far as means testing, and then the cost of the insurance, Blue Cross Blue Shield, you're starting to chew up a lot of this money in administrative costs that are duplicative.
Well, I understand that the Office of Private Health Partnerships is going to be much more flexible and
whenever we change the name, I've noticed it really does help out, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Ms. Binney, thank you very much for your testimony. Two points that she brought up that certainly need to be looked at. One is the FEOP application is too complex. I mean, with her experience, she has to call her carrier to get help, then we got to look at the application because other employers may have similar concerns. And the second is, that's a good point, that if we're going to be paying COBRA payments at $511 a month, you know, when is it more efficient or more, I guess, economical to just use Oregon Health Plan as compared to that kind of money? We have additional public testimony. Did you have a comment,
well,
Representative Hansen?
A question for Rocky, and you can get back to me on this. If through this, the state licenses insurance providers, do we also license, like, what products? What I'm wondering, is there a list of all of the various insurance products that employers are able to buy? Could we go through that and see which ones are eligible so that the employer only had to just list that I have Regency, Blue Cross, whatever plan, and then that you would know at that point whether the plan qualifies to the matched up with the debt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, first of all, I have the one-page form that employers are required to fill out, which doesn't relate to doing a benchmark of what the plan is. All they have to do is provide a benefit summary. We do the benchmarking. The employer doesn't do it. The primary piece of information they have to fill out has to do the top part and the bottom part with the employee, to how much are they contributing, what is the share of the employee share, what's the employer share. But I'll share this with the committee, and I'll make sure everybody gets a copy of it.
Now, you're talking about the individual application for an employee. Is that correct?
Now, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we were talking about the difficulty that an employer has. There's two the employer doesn't make an application. All they do is, it's called an employee verification form. Who's the employee? When's the insurance available? What's the Social Security? We have to verify that person's working there and what the contributions and premiums are for the different plans. Once an employer, for example, an employer with 20 employees, five are on FEOP. Once that employer one time gives their benefit summary to us that we've basically benchmarked it, they don't have to do that for every employee. Then they just have to fill out the individual information. How often is the employee paid? Is it weekly? Is it monthly? Is it?
I think that what Ellen Penny was referring to was the description of what the benefits are, because you may ask questions that are specific enough that most people don't really know without getting input. They either go read the contract or they get input from their provider.
Yeah. And Representative Hansen, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen does have a good idea, though, in that we tried to explore, and that is having the companies actually certify their plans as meeting the benchmark. We can't require that, but what we've done is develop an inventory of those plans that we already have certification on. Mm-hmm. So it's really the plans going through at one time, and once that's taken place, we have a record as to whether they meet that or not.
Senator Winters.
No, just wanted to follow up on some comments that, that Senator Bates had made with respect to looking at streamlining and the process, and looking also that since a lot of the work is being done by DHS, whether or not that that could be a way of reducing your overhead costs. And I was reminded of while he was talking of White City and our commitment last couple sessions ago in looking at even at DHS as methods to streamline where we're not doing duplication of effort. And I would encourage us to continue to look at areas where there is duplication, and if there are ways that we can make it not only easier for the recipient of our services, but also to reduce the amount of overhead cost that we're currently doing. And I think it's something worth exploring.
I agree. Just to kind of follow up on the idea of the plans, if you know, I don't know how many plans there are in Oregon. You know, we know how many carriers there are, and they're all registered and so forth. But would it save a lot of time and effort if you knew what plans there were, and that they qualified or they didn't qualify, and then it would just be, you know, plan 4065, and you don't have to go into what the benefits are because it's a group plan that's already in your file?
Mr. Chair, that's what I was speaking to, is that we have, over the last years, begun the development of that inventory of plans that qualify versus those plans that don't qualify. There are 176 licensed carriers in the state, and, for example, Blue Cross may, at one point, had as many as 2,000 different plans out there. That's one carrier. A lot of other carriers don't have that many, obviously, but there are thousands of plans out there that different employers purchase.
I guess the first employee of the XYZ company who fills out the application, at that point you then know what XYZ has, and so when the second one does, they wouldn't have to go through the same hoops as
Mr.
far as...
Mr. Chair, that is correct. They wouldn't have to provide as much information. The second employee, or actually it's the employer, doesn't have to provide as much information on the second employee as perhaps they would on the first. So you're certifying the employer's plan at that point. Whether it's one employee or 50, it does make a difference.
Okay, one final point on what Ms. Penny brought up that I think is important, and that is, as we've talked about groups, I know that there's one focus that you have is signing up new groups that don't have any group coverage, and yet I could certainly see that in existing groups, when they hire someone, it would be very helpful if that person couldn't afford the coverage to be able to have the help. But it's already an existing group, so it's on a per-employee basis, and not let's get a new group in this company that doesn't have any coverage. For one thing, I think that puts the employer in a pretty tough situation where the funding is going to be an issue 2 years from now, and he's deciding is he going to add group coverage or not add it, when his motivation today might be different if he lost the ability to have the coverage, the payments for all of his group.
Ms. Chair, I wish that I had my marketing person here, because we have met with hundreds of businesses throughout Oregon. Every business in this state who has more than 100 employees, I think represents Hannah's company, for example, both the HR person and the CEO or the CFO of that company have been contacted in terms of mail-outs, packets of information, offering to come to their companies. We have made probably 300 or 400 presentations to companies. We go up to Eastern Oregon, bring our... That outreach really is working.
Good. Yep. Any questions? If not, I'd like to go to our next public testimony, Ellen Lowe.
Mr. Chair, Senator, could I just have brought one question with regard to Dr. Bates' idea? I mean, could there be an automatic referral to you guys? DHS does the means testing, and oop, they're 5 cents or $5 over. Could you get an automatic referral to those clients? At that point in time, that's your market.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, we do now. If someone, for example, has group coverage available to them, they notify us immediately. Now that their standard program is closed, they're sending over the application or materials or the inquiry, because right now they don't necessarily fill out an application, but they send that materials over to us now.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Lowe.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Ellen Lowe, and I appear today without portfolio, but maybe with several. Actually, I am a member of the Insurance Pool Governing Board, and I welcome the move to the new name because I always had trouble saying IPGB, and I think really the description of being advisory rather than policy is perhaps a more apt description of what the role of the board has been. I would like to make a couple of comments. One, several of you have picked up on something that Ellen Penny was quoting me and talking about how I felt that the carrier could play a more prominent role in the certification of plans that they sell than being eligible for the FEOP subsidy. And I think often the insurance agent or the broker could also be part of that process and make it more streamlined. I would like to comment on one of the things that Senator Bates suggested, and where I see that maybe there is a role for a separate eligibility process in FEOP than there is for the Medicaid part of the Oregon Health Plan in DHS. And it goes back to remembering a number of hearings that I've attended through the years in other parts of the state, not just Salem or Portland, in which it was made very clear by those who came to testify, both insurance agents, carriers, and more importantly, consumers, that they looked on FEOP as not being welfare, not being DHS. Now, the first time I heard that, I sat up straight because I knew that there were federal and state dollars going, at that time it was just state dollars rather than federal and state, going into the subsidy, so I saw it as public assistance. But there very definitely is a different attitude about FEOP. And generally, the folks who I have been in contact with through the years have been part of the working poor in Oregon, because that's why they qualify, really, because of their income. But there are folks who look forward to raising that level of income. I've heard some of you comment about that the length of stay that some people are on the program. I would say some of that is related to their income escalating. And if you look at the FEOP level of subsidy, what you will see is that the subsidy goes down as the income goes up. But those folks are establishing a relationship with an employer, often with an insurance agent or a broker, and I think there is a different feeling about this. And so, in a way, it's planting something that will continue to grow. And I think it contributes to something that I know personally has significant value in healthcare, and that's continuity of coverage and continuity of service, where they will most likely then be with the same health service providers and stay within that community. The other thing, I know you have some limited time. As a longtime member of the board, and most of you know, I'm also one of those who's been on the Health Services Commission what seems like forever, and used to tutor Dr. Bates in that role. But anyway, I have been part of the Oregon Health Plan from the very beginning. And so I looked at one of the real strengths of the OHP as the expansion population. And so I would hope that maybe part of the legislative initiative that you can provide, maybe initiative isn't the word, maybe it's more push, that in looking at the waiver, that you look at a way so that the waiver for FEOP is looked at as dealing with what we call the expansion population, so that perhaps part of that could be also made available for Oregon Health Plan standard, because that is one of the tragedies, I think, in terms of the continuity of service to Oregonians. Again, I want to pay particular homage to Rocky King and the staff. Ellen Penny mentioned how she felt the attitude there in terms of dealing with her and other members of the public was outstanding. I think the fact that they were the kind of commercials they've been able to do, the sort of workshops and training that they do with insurance agents and brokers across the state, if there's anything that's an example of private-public partnership and energy, it's what has come out of Rocky King and his employees, and I applaud them, and it has been an honor for me to have been associated with them. But the one thing that I know was not Rocky's doing, and so I hope you will give some real energy to dealing with our waiver discussions involving the expansion population, so that we can serve both those who are not part of that working population I first alluded to. We can serve them with health service, but also make sure that we have given a boost to those who are going to become part of Oregon's future economy, as well as contributing to it now. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Any questions? Senator Westland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to point out, while I certainly agree with and underscore your comments with regard to Mr. King and his efforts and the way he runs his shop, I would also like to caution the committee to take much of what Ms. Lowe says with a grain of salt. She is obviously wearing her San Francisco Giant colors today. This has a great deal of influence on me as it relates to their opening against the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Yes, I believe it's 105 today, Mr. Chair and Senator Westland.
He's very observant.
Mr. Chair, this isn't the first time we've had a discussion about a long-term rivalry.
Yes. Well, thank you, Ms. Lowe. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Coming in. And I have to add to what's been said about Rocky King. You know, I have had late-night sessions with him and with others trying to get my tutorial going as I've gone through Human Services 101 this session, and he's been a tremendous asset and resource. Are there any other comments, questions? Is there any other public testimony today relating to the insurance pool governing board soon to be extinct? Seeing none, then without objection, we will go ahead and adjourn this meeting.